What do you want to play, Sam?
We're going to play Take Me Out to the Ball Game. We're all going to sing it, too.
To yet another edition of Meet Me at Mutual. I'm your host, Daniel Shoptaw, C70 at the Bat, at C70 on Twitter, and you've got Alan Medlock from the Redbird Daily and AMedlock1 on Twitter with you tonight. We're going to get back to the favorite players like we did last week, and we'll get to as many of those as we can in the second part of the show. We'll see how long the first part takes before we decide how many players we're going to deal with. But anyway, so but the big news, of course, this week is the shakeup and finalization of the coaching staff. We already knew that we had the two spots open for a pitching coach, which the Cardinals are looking to redo a little bit, and bullpen coach. Earlier this week, we found out David Bell was going out to San Francisco to become the head of their farm director, or farm system, which left the bench coach job open. Cardinals didn't waste any time, and Alan, I know you have been excited, especially about the speed of how these things have settled out. But they filled these positions with Mike Shildt moving from third base, Jose Oquendo returning to the staff to be third base, and then Willie McGee hired to, I guess, be an outfield base running coach. And then yesterday hiring Mike Maddox outside the organization, a guy with a very solid reputation, and promoting Brian Evansgard from Memphis as the pitching coach and the bullpen coach, respectively. You know, just as an overview of this, and like I said, you've been excited about how fast it's gone. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I really like the movement, as quick as everything has been. I know that you and I talked about it quite a bit off the air about it. I would like to think, I think that the staff they put in is great. I don't know how much different it is from previous years. I'm glad they brought Oquendo back. I'm really glad they got McGee. And it sounds like Maddox was the right hire. We know him just from, competitive, coaching for the competitors and all that for all those years. And of course, his brother and pitching in the bigs. But, I hope it all works out, and I think it's going to, but you're right. I'm just glad that they're taking care of business and checking off all these boxes before they have to go. They get into the bidding wars and get into the not so cut and dry player portion of it. I think that bringing these guys back and kind of stepping out of their comfort zone for the pitching coach shows that they mean business this year, and I'm excited. So that's the urgency on that. It seems like we've seen that. I can't remember a year that we've seen a move this quickly on these kind of things, just to kind of line everything up and get ready to move right into the free agency period.
Interesting. They could have, they wanted to have their staff in place by 11-1, and they did. Something that could have easily drug out, especially when you look at the pitching coaches and the battle over Jim Hickey and things like that could have been. But we'll get to that part in a little bit. But let's kind of take them just one by one. And, they moved Mike Shildt into the bench coach role. And, a couple years ago, whenever they hired David Bell, kind of wished that they had hired somebody that had a lot of, kind of a veteran manager, a guy that had some experience, a guy that, really could, mold Matheny to some degree. And David Bell had some experience in managing, but he really didn't seem to fit that role. And I don't think Mike Shildt fits it in that description either, but You know, Shields has managed in the minor leagues. He's kind of seen this organization from a lot of different ways. Been in the organization for quite some time. I think it's going to be interesting to see how he and Matheny interact in this way, because, you know, the Cardinals move him into that position that, you know, is kind of like the, you know, second in command, a place that grooms managers. And I'm not saying that they're grooming Mike Shildt to be Mike Matheny's replacement. I'm not saying that necessarily, but, you know, it could be that he's, you know, he could be in line to be a manager somewhere else in a few years. But it is kind of interesting, and I think an indication of how highly the organization thinks of him to see him in that spot.
Yeah, and that's, you took the words out of my mouth. It just shows that, you know, last year they basically found a job for him. You know, the quality control coordinator. You know, no one really knew what was going on. I mean, we even, you know, we did a Q&A last year with Mo in the early days of the Redbird Daily, and he filled out a questionnaire for. It was really interesting, and that was the question I asked. I said, well, what will the details of this new coach be? And it was basically, and you can go back and read, I may even repost it, was to blend the analytical side with the on-the-field side and to kind of do yeoman's work is basically how he described it, which I thought was interesting. So last year during the firing, I wondered how he was going to fit in, and I loved going to third. Yeah, coach at third base, because obviously that's what he did in Memphis, you know, the whole time. And outside of, you know, that's one of his, you know, that's one of the deals you do is one of the coach. But you read a lot about him, and he's a super interesting guy. And you just wonder if some of the new analytical side things that they're kind of going, that they're approaching, if that he is not kind of the, kind of at the forefront of that right now for the organization. And I agree with you. I don't know if this is necessarily to take the job if anything were to fall apart. But I do feel like this puts him in the best position moving forward, whether it's a manager of the Cardinals or a manager of somebody else. And I think they think of him highly, so high that he's right at that next step. So I don't know. I kind of liked him. I read an interesting story about him a couple years ago. And I read a little of the background of George Kissel's son and Shielder, you know, have grown really close. And he hands out copies of the manuals to players that Kissel wrote. And, you know, if that's bridging the analytical side of it to the Cardinals' history side of it. So, I don't know. I think it's a great move, and I'm a big fan of his. So, I'm curious to see how this all plays out. I'm not one of those, you know, to go fire. Yeah, I know that it's really, really popular right now, especially since we see a lot of these other managers that have made the playoffs lose their jobs. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I do think that a slow start, depending on the player movement, I think there's going to be enough player movement to where it probably buys you at least the first half of the season. But if there wasn't much player movement and they started 3-9, it could be a pretty interesting situation next year.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we pointed out, and we might hit on this again as we go through this, but, you know, at least three of these guys could be potentially a manager if the Cardinals decide to go that way. And you're right. I mean, I think even more so if they do player movement, if they have this idea that they're going all out and the team scuffles early, you know, maybe. It's hard to really believe that the Cardinals are going to cut on Matheny very quickly, just because they haven't yet. I mean, like you said, you know, you saw three guys that made it into the playoffs get fired this year. You know, at this rate, you're going to see, you know, Dave Roberts or the manager of the Astros get fired, whoever didn't win this thing. That just seems to be the way it goes. Every round, there was somebody getting fired. But
the one thing I was going to say, and like I said, I apologize for cutting you off. I don't want this to look like that I was hoping that Maddox would be the pitching coach the whole time. To be honest with you, I really thought it was going to be Eversgaard the whole time. And I was thinking, well, I think that's probably what they'll do, and then they'll groom him. And then I think you even said, well, if he doesn't get the pitching coach, he's going to be the bullpen coach. I honestly thought that Maddox would take the managerial job in Washington. And I was like, how far off base they can get after winning 97 games. I'm not so sure. You know, down in Washington, that is.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I was like, I could see them just promoting Maddox, and that would make the most sense. But it didn't happen, and I, like I said, I really didn't pay attention to what was going on with them because you can't really do much until the playoffs are over anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised to see that Maddox was still available because I naturally thought he was going to slide over into that. So I was actually pleasantly surprised because I didn't. I thought the Hickey deal was set in stone. You know, the minute that Bosio was gone, I thought that that was a done deal. And you know, anybody else, I didn't really give much thought to. I just kind of thought it would be I thought it would be Everett's guard the whole time. So I was surprised that it was Maddox in the first place. When you brought up that there could be three potential managers behind Matheny at this point, I actually thought that was the next step for Maddox anyway.
Well, yeah, and that seems to be, and we'll just go ahead and scoot over to Maddox then now while we're talking about him. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't really given much thought to Maddox as a manager because you just don't. I mean, you know, some of those guys, you just have them pigeonholed in your head as pitching coaches because that's what you hear, that's what you do. I mean, Dave Duncan, you know, I'm sure he probably could have managed, but you always just thought of him as a pitching coach. And I don't say just a pitching coach, because he's obviously very, very good, but, you know, that just managerial doesn't necessarily enter your mind unless you're kind of being a think-outside-the-box type of thing. But I did read somewhere in some of the write-ups on Maddox where, yeah, he was thought of as managerial material, at least in recent memory. I don't, you know, obviously... I don't think anybody was looking at him necessarily right now, but probably not. Since he took the pitching coach job, he probably would have held out if somebody had given him any indication he was going to be a manager. But, you know, I think it's a really interesting move for them. You know, to go outside the organization, as I pointed out, this is probably the least tied hire of any sort since, well, I said Tony La Russa, and then Derek Gould came around and, you know, said Dave Duncan, who was hired just a few minutes after Tony La Russa, so, you know, technically correct, whatever. But basically that. I mean, and you don't hire Duncan if you don't get, you don't get Duncan if you didn't get La Russa, so. But, I mean, you got to go back to there. To find somebody that comes out from outside the organization with no ties. I mean, yeah, you have to go back to Mark McGuire, I think, is what, you know, what to find a real hire that was outside the organization, period. And, you know, obviously McGuire had significant, you know, ties to St. Louis. He just wasn't in the organization at the time. And that's, you know, and we've talked about that. It's one of the organization's strengths for a while has been to be able to promote from within and keep that Cardinal way and keep that focus and keep, you know, everything just humming right along. But, you know, it's kind of broken down a little bit, and it's good to get somebody from the outside. It's good to get a guy that's, you know, there's not very many pitching coaches that you can name, and Mike Maddox is one of them. You know, and apparently, again, take it for what it's worth, take it for whatever, but it appears that Maddox really was their pick over Jim Hickey. You know, maybe that's because they realized they couldn't get Hickey and they decided that Maddox was better. Or it could be they really did like him. I mean, there's some indication that the Cardinals were, you know, big on him. Maybe really had a chance on Jim Hickey, even though, like you said, it seemed Chicago was a no-brainer as soon as they fired Chris Bosio because they pretty much fired Chris Bosio to get him. But, you know, Mike Maddox is a guy that he's been around. He's done some really good work, you know, in Texas, which is not a pitcher's ballpark by any means, in Milwaukee, in Washington. He had some good arms to deal with. And like you pointed out, and we'll talk a little bit about that, you know, what you got to figure the arms of the Cardinals is got to be a significant draw for a guy coming in because not only do they have currently good arms like Carlos Martinez, but they got some arms coming up and, you know, and Alex Reyes, Luke Weaver, whatever, that have to be fun to work with.
Yeah, that was the first thing that popped into my mind is if you remember that big series where the Cardinals were going for the sweep and it was Martinez and Scherzer on the Sunday night game, and Martinez gave up could be a draw. You never know. I mean, and it's something that this will get deadpan the minute that anybody listens to it. But you never know if some of these guys may want to work with Matheny. You know, I mean, that could be a situation as well. I don't know, and you know that no one will agree with that. But I think there's a lot of positives and you know, what they have in the big leagues now and arms coming up.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I don't know. I can't quite make the jump to people wanting to work with Matheny just because I don't think Matheny's got any kind of legendary cachet or anything.
It may have been a reach, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I think that there are people that, put it this way, they don't mind working with Matheny. Or they might like Matheny as a person, and they're fine, you know, fine working with him there. I'm not saying you have to... you have to pull teeth to get them to work with Matheny. I'm not saying that, and I think that's kind of what you're going with too. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely an interest. I've got a figure, a guy that has seen the St. Louis organization from, you know, not necessarily real close up, although when he was with Milwaukee, it was kind of kind of close by. Might have been interesting, and it may have just come down to the money too. I mean, we have no idea what they offer these guys or whatever, but. Whatever the case, if they're going to go to this pitching coordinator role, which it does feel like that they are, and the pitching coach is going to have more say in who pitches and when they pitch and how long they stay out there and things like that, it feels like Maddox is a pretty good guy for that. I'm a little surprised, just because of how long he's been around, that he would fit into this, you know, kind of sabermetric overview that the Cardinals seem to have, but... It seems like that may be kind of in his wheelhouse too, you know. And again, he's worked with some good pitchers, and he's made some pitchers that are not so good work pretty well. So we'll have to wait and see on that one. And I guess that's, you know, the only thing that would overshadow Mike Maddox had to be the return of Jose Oquendo, and I'm not 100% sure that it did. You know, it's kind of an even thing, but both very, very exciting for fans on both of those things. You know, Jose Oquendo has spent 2 years in Florida. All indications were that he was happy working with prospects. He was at home. He was, you know, not having to travel with the organization. And from what I read, it was Mozeliak and Matheny going down to talk to him. Decided it was enough in the benefit of the big club to do whatever it took to get Oquendo to come to the big leagues. And I think that's an interesting thing to kind of speculate. What did it take to get Oquendo to come back?
Yeah, I know, that's a great question. It's there's a bunch of theories out there. Yeah, no, so I would love to think that it was probably health, and then may have thought that it was probably, I'm far enough away now that you know, we can do this. And that's one of those deals, and we talk about this, it seems to be every show, you know, the fly on the wall factor of finding out what really was the breaking point, either A, him leaving, or, you know, even coming back now. So, I don't know. Did we ever figure out the figures on that?
On
money-wise?
I haven't seen any financial information on any of the coaches.
I haven't either. I don't know if I've ever known of a coach. You know, I don't know anybody's salary. So.
Yeah, I think Matheny's is probably out there. I don't remember what it is, but yeah, it's possible they don't. But yeah, I don't think the coaches tend to do that. But you got to figure, you know, it was a significant amount of money to get him out of that. And you got to think, I mean, from all indications, and again, you take for what it's worth, and, you know, I can't prove that. I don't even know where I heard it, so I can't tell you what the source was. I think some of Google, some other places. But this idea that Oquendo wanted a little bit more autonomy, he wanted a little bit more authority. If he wanted to do drills, you know, before a game, then people were going to do drills. And it sounded like last time he was there, he tried to do that, and Matheny might overrule him or whatever, and that's not going to happen now. And I think that's interesting. I mean, especially after 2 years of baseball that's been very sloppy, or at least in parts, to have a little bit more of a taskmaster mentality. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that has never been Mike Matheny. Mike Matheny has never been a taskmaster, and the staff has tended to, as most staffs do, tend to take after the guy at the top. But so getting a guy in like Oquendo, and then you got a guy like Mike Maddux, who has the pitchers chart the game, you know, next day starter charts the game, which I thought was more of a standard procedure. Apparently it's not anymore. Things like that, you know, like the guy, Moz's algorithm on Twitter pointed out, you know, between those two guys and Willie McGee being a guy that's going to make you, you know, run drills again and again and again until you get it right. There may be more of an edge. There may be more of a, you know, we're not messing around type of attitude in the clubhouse this year, even before you start swapping in players.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's you could really tell that they're trying to get back to some more of the fundamentals of what's made the organization great. And that's the very first thing that that Jen Langosh mentioned after the hiring was that not only was Oquendo loved by guys, but that he was super respected because he would confront a lot of issues and make you work through. And that just kind of shows how far off base everything's been, you know, in the past couple of years. I don't know. I think it's a successful offseason already just by bringing these guys back. I know that there's a little skepticism just of the, I guess, notoriety. I don't know if that's the correct word that I want to use, but there's some apprehension of bringing these guys back just for, you know, honorary captain's sake. But, I mean, I think it's going to work, and it sounds like they went and got guys that aren't afraid to confront issues or aren't afraid of conflict.
Yeah, it does feel like that. And again, I think we get to, yeah, let's talk a little bit about Oquendo and McGee. You know, that was, I think, a little bit of my fear. Not as much with Oquendo, but definitely with McGee. That it's this idea that they're going to appeal to nostalgia. Because, I mean, you know, everybody loves Oquendo. Everybody loves McGee, and rightfully so. I'm not disagreeing with that. But we love them as players. And Oquendo, like I said, Oquendo has done stuff as a coach. You know, and you feel like you know what you're going to get with Oquendo. What's going to help, you know, the defense was better when he was there. Positioning was better when he was there. Stuff like that. You figure that's going to help and improve. But you got Willie, and again, I'm not criticizing the hire. I think it very well may work out, and I know he's been a roving instructor somewhat. But we've never seen, you know, never seen him coach at on a full level. We don't know what how he's gonna be able to turn players around if he is. You know, the cynical people would say, hey, yeah, this is a ploy to get everybody excited because they get the old names back, the gang back together. And, you know, that gives them cover in case something goes, you know, they don't do anything this offseason. I don't think that's what we're going for here. And I think it's more of an attempt to try to get back. I'm not going to say get back to the 80s because I don't think the 80s works now. I don't think that type of style would work as much as everybody seems to grab a hold of that because of how successful Whitey Herzog was. You also got to remember that Whitey played on our AstroTurf field that had a 400 and something foot center field, you know, was it 414 for a while, with a bunch of Jackrabbits. I mean, you know, one, we don't have the personnel, but two, the game is different than it was. I mean, you know, what, nobody steals 100 bases now. Nobody steals, you know, hardly anybody steals 75 bases. So, you know, but I think that bringing those guys in helps bring back that mindset, that toughness, that idea of fundamentals. You just look at them every day and you can say, look, when Oquendo or McGee wants you to do something, you kind of do it because they've had the experience and they've been there and they've had the success because of what they've done.
Yeah, that's without a doubt. I mean, that's I'm curious to see. I never want to do, after these hires, mm-hmm. but he wanted to, you know, his he wanted his daughters to, you know, to be out of the house or whatever, and to be grown up and comfortable with that before he could do it. You know, I guess he still has a 15-year-old son, but it's a situation where I guess the son's going to come with him, you know, outside of his league play and stuff like that. So that made me feel a little bit better about it. I knew that he was always an instructor, and for some reason, just McGee's persona to me always felt like it was probably more of he knew what he was talking about as opposed to, you know, let's bring back the glory days like situation. So yeah, I hope that it, I think it'll work out. I'm curious to see what will be the title on that whenever it's all said and done. Kind of back to the Whitey Ball era, but it not working. I mean, that was, if you remember, there in the 80s, 20 home runs out of guys was a lot. Now, I'm just mm-hmm. not saying Cardinals, but anybody in the league, you know, McGuire, and, you know, in 87, he came and kind of blew that out of the water. I remember, you know, Clark, you know, Strawberry hit 25 in 86, I believe. And I remember it seemed like he hit one out every week. And, you know, 25 is just kind of commonplace now. You mm-hmm. know, there was five or six Cardinals this year that had 20 on, you know, what could be considered an average at best offense. So, yeah, the game's different. It doesn't work like that. And as much as it was exciting and nice to see, I hope that's not what they're going for. I hope it's more of a, these guys know what they're talking about. They've got the track record to prove it. And if you don't walk the line with them, they're going to let you know about it.
Yeah, I feel like that's where we're at. But it is going to be interesting to see, you know, what they can do with that. Because, you know, right now, at least, it's still the same players. You know, that may change, and we'll see. We probably will. I mean, obviously will some, but for the most part, these guys are still there. And so you can only do so much with these guys. Even as much as you try and much as you drill, you know, there may not be that much there. So it is a little hard, you know. I don't, you know, the blame is not going to go to Okendo. It's not going to go to McGee. It's not going to mainly even go to Maddox if the Cardinals don't do well. It's going to go to Mike Matheny. I guess that's a good thing for these guys, huh? You know, I mean, they're pretty safe because, you know, there's a section of the fan base that if the team improves, it's because of McGee. It's because of these guys. But if they don't, then it's Matheny not getting it done. And, I don't know what the level, there's some truth to that maybe. I don't know. But it is interesting, though. And we'll wrap by going back to this point. It is interesting that the club is putting so many strong managerial possibilities out there. And again, I don't think Matheny's in danger, and I don't think necessarily the club wants him to think he's in danger. But I do think, you know, they're trying to limit him as much as possible, it feels like. You know, giving a pitching coach more say, giving Okendo more authority, things like that. It's almost like they're managing their manager. Alan?
Yeah, you were cutting out real bad.
Oh, sorry. I was just saying, I was just going to repeat that, you know, they're managing their manager, it feels like. So, I mean, that's a little bit different.
No, I agree with that. And it is, you're exactly right about the strong personalities that they brought in, or strong candidates to take that job. And I, you and I are in agreement on that. I mean, as much as people want to hear that, you know, even Bernie's really kind of pushing forward a little bit. Hey, if these guys can lose their jobs, be it Boston, mm-hmm. you know, then it can happen here too. I just don't think that's close. But you do have a good point. I mean, there are guys now that can take the job in a heartbeat. So I don't think he's been put on notice per se, but it does look like they've got a good crew of upper level guys.
Yep. All right. Well, I think we've done as much on these guys. Like I said, it's interesting to see them fill the staff quickly. It's interesting to see them, especially in the case of Maddox, go out and be the first one to sign a player, you know, sign a guy. Whether that was their first choice or not, it's a definitely different story. But they did sign Maddox before anybody else sign their coach. You know, it looks like Hickey's going to Chicago. It looks like Bosio's going to Detroit. But, you know, the Cardinals got their guy and got him first, which, you know, maybe it signals an aggressiveness that we're going to see when it comes to players as well. I don't know. You got to kind of hope.
Exactly. I was going to say, I hope it's not wishful thinking on my part. But, I mean, them acting so quick tells me that they are going to – I think they'll strike quick for one of the needs. You know, where they, whatever trade they're working on, that could be the quickest one. But whichever one takes the most work, I think they're going to really focus on that and take care of the other needs a little bit soon, you know, sooner rather than later. Yeah.
All right, well, is there anything else about the coaching staff you want to talk about, or are you ready to move on into our players?
Yeah, let's discuss some players.
All right. Last week we started this off, this favorite Cardinal players that y'all voted in. Y'all gave us the input, and we kind of summed them all up. We went through last week about 30-something names that everybody that got 4 points or fewer in our file. And so this week we're going to just start at 5 and work our way up for a bit and see how long it takes us. Hopefully we'll get all the way to 10, but we'll start here with the people that earned 5 points in our system. Royce Clayton, J.D. Drew, Adam Kennedy, Gerald Laird, and Tony Scott. Again, Alan does not know the names until I read them off to him. So, I read them off to him and then make him decide who he wants to talk about, because that's the kind of guy I am. So
here's what's funny about. Go ahead.
No, I want to turn it over to you and let you. What do you think?
It is funny that those guys all made the same list, because I don't know. I don't know if you can name me in the rest of this list three players that were, with their timing of being Cardinals, were really bad. Clayton taking Ozzie's job. J.D. Drew being J.D. Adam Kennedy wasn't the savior that he was expecting. You know, so I don't know if any of those three are held in very high regard as Cardinals. You know, Laird as the backup catcher, he's always it's like a backup quarterback type situation. Mm-hmm. You know, one of those deals. Right when you read those off, that was the first thing that popped into my mind. I was like, man, Wick Clayton, great player, wasn't universally liked in St. Louis, because he is always going to be incorporated with LaRusse's decision to sit Ozzie. Adam Kennedy. I remember that signing. I was so excited about it, because I had actually watched him play when he was in the Cardinals system, you know, coming through Tulsa. And, you know, he was a shortstop. That was before he moved to second base. And he could play. And whenever they traded him off, he was like, okay, well, you know, we'll see. Then he goes and hits the 3 bombs in the World Series. And, you know, comes back. And he just never really materialized, you know, for him in St. Louis. And then, you know, the J.D. which is interesting, because I know that you and I have had a lot of talks about this, and even I remember having a long conversation about this the night before the blogger event, and Drew was brought up. He's what a skill set to never materialize. You know, I feel like I beat up on him quite a bit, but I mean, he could have been such a stud. I remember at Florida State, and he was by far the best player on the field in the College World Series that he played in. Then he gets drafted, then decides not to play in Philadelphia. You know, plays in Minneapolis a little bit, and ultimately ends up in St. Louis. And he seemed like a pariah for such a good guy, you know. So I don't know. It's interesting those guys are all on the same list, are in the same category right there. I guess being the five pointers, everybody thought of them the same.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, J.D. Drew, you look at his time in St. Louis, he hit .282. He slugged .498. You know, injuries got to him, and some of that was iffy injuries, I'll give you that, but some of it, I mean, one time, if I remember right, it was David Wells that broke his hand, you know, hit him and broke his wrist, he was out for quite some time, you know, that kind of thing, you can't really blame on, you know, being soft or anything like that, it just happens. You know, people, I don't know, I always felt that J.D. Drew was kind of a whipping boy, kind of, the guy that got worse. Do you remember the night he debuted?
Not. It's not in my memory.
you remember the night he debuted. You just don't remember him debuting that night, because he debuted later in the game after McGuire hit 62. His first game, they called him up a couple of nights before, and I think the guys at the Birds on the Bat show, I think I heard them tell the story that I talked to Mark Little, who was also called up at the time. And they called Mark Little up basically because he had a house or a place in St. Louis, and so J.D. Drew could have a place to stay, because the hotels were packed because of McGuire's race. So he got his first call up just because, you know, right place, right time, and he got to be the guy that got called up so J.D. Drew could have a couch, something like that. But yeah, J.D. Drew made his debut September 8th, 1998, I think about the, you know, McGuire, I think, hit his home run in the third inning, and Drew came in the sixth or seventh. And like I said, had a great, I don't want to say great career, but he had a solid career in St. Louis. Never did capture the imagination of the fans, and that's big. And then, of course, you know, he got traded for Adam Wainwright. I mean, there was more to it than that, but, you know,
Yeah. When
you look at it that way, you got to appreciate Drew a little bit because of that. And that's kind of the same thing with Adam Kennedy. He was part of that deal. He was, like you said, he came up with the Cardinals system. He went with Kent Bottenfield for Jim Edmonds. So if nothing else, those two guys have brought in some major talent that the Cardinal organization will never forget.
That's a great point. It almost, and not to get too far, I can really go off of J.D. Drew, and I probably should. And I don't know, and I think that's probably the expectations of, I saw he was so good.
Yeah.
Florida State. And then ultimately he was pretty good in Boston. But even from St. Louis to Boston, or L.A. to Boston, you know, Atlanta, there was always a lack of effort, deception with him. You know, our lack of caring. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I may be completely wrong on that. I don't know. But it just kind of seemed like that to me. And it seemed like La Russa had even mentioned something along those lines.
Oh, yeah. La Russa wrote about it in Three Nights in August. Talking about Drew's lack of desire to get better, desire to do anything more than what he could do naturally. And there's some of that, but you know, I also think, and we've talked about this before too, you know, some of that is just, you know, outward appearance too. I mean, you look at Stephen Piscotty, a guy that's fairly even keeled, except for occasional bad words when he strikes out. But for the most part, a kind of an even keel type of guy, and I think sometimes he gets misconstrued as well. You know, they're guys that are not going to show their hearts on their sleeve, but as fans, sometimes, you know, when there's a big misplay or where there's something frustration that comes out, you'd like to see that they care about that, and they don't always show that. And when they don't show that, I think it kind of rubs fans the wrong way, even though it probably shouldn't.
Yeah, and that's, you never know what's going on with these guys, and I don't know. I mean, it's tough to defend Drew on one of those. And not, like I said, he may be a great guy. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But everything kind of leads to the fact that he probably is. But yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, you never know.
Yeah. And like you said, Royce Clayton was, I mean, that's just, you forget about, you know, I think I'd have to look it up, but I think he had a good couple of years before he was traded to Texas, I think. Mm-hmm. He go in the Tatis deal? I'll have to look that up. For some reason, I want to say they got Fernando Tatis back in the deal that sent Clayton to Texas. Transactions.
The timeline probably works, but it seems like Tatis.
Yep.
Because was that what it was?
Traded by the Cardinals with Todd Stottlemyre for player to be named later, Darren Oliver and Fernando Tatis.
I knew Oliver was involved. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's, Tatis was a stud too, though. I mean, he's one of those guys. guys that I got to see every night here in Tulsa.
Yeah.
He was a good player.
Yeah. Also, ironically, the player to be named later in that deal was Mark Little, who actually, it says, was sent, and it was sent on August 9th, so, yeah, just, you know, a month later was called up, so, kind of funny how that worked.
I personally know Mark Little.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he is actually in the cinema industry now, so
oh, cool.
You need a guest on
We might have to do that at some point in time. But yeah, Clayton, Clayton came into a terrible situation, not helped, I mean, by the fact that Tony La Russa, I don't want to say he was dishonest in what he said. I think he had a different mindset and did not communicate that to Ozzy as well as he could have. You know, basically that Ozzy really, really had to be awesome. Clayton was going to be the starter, and, you know, I'm not sure that either one of those people treated that the best, but Ozzy probably deserved, and I think Clayton was just the kind of the innocent bystander in all this. He just kind of got the, because Ozzy got mad, then people are going to be mad at the guy that's taking his place, even if, you know, it's really not his fault. That's a tough situation, and, you know, you're not likely to see Royce Clayton hanging around the ballpark anytime soon, so... but, you know, it was time for Ozzy to go, unfortunately. I don't think... I mean, he had a good 96, but I don't think he would have been really wanting to play any more than that. And so, you got to do what you got to do, unfortunately. And like I said, I'm not saying that Tony La Russa was right on that, but I can understand why he would want to start a younger guy, even over a Hall of Famer like Ozzy.
Yeah, and it just shows that... spring doesn't mean...
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because Ozzy, the only... Because it wasn't even a question who was going to be the starting superstar. You know, coming into the season, it was kind of one of those, you know, last hurrahs for Ozzy. Well, Ozzy had a huge spring.
Yeah.
And felt like they won the job. And that's where the issues started. And it just kind of shows that spring doesn't... The spring wait is not the same for him. And I mean that in Marissa's eyes, really.
Yeah. I think that's what it was just kind of a miscommunication and some different ideas about what that was and how much spring was going to really wait. And you're right. So,
as any Hall of Famer, this is going to go on deaf ears because everybody was going to know it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever been around Ozzy at all, and I'm not acting like we meet up on the weekend, but I've met him before. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, that is a prideful guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, even if you call out his golf swing, he goes at people. So it's one of those where you can see that his tenacity to overcome the things that he did to become a Hall of Famer, become a best shortstop in maybe history. Yeah, it's one of those where that lent itself to the animosity with the person, too. I have no mm-hmm. doubt about that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were definitely two very hard-headed guys going at it, and that wasn't a situation that was going to work out well, most likely at all. So, all right, well, let's move on up to the six-pointers. We're getting serious now. Rafael Belliard, Cesar Cedeno, Frankie Frisch, Sixto Lescano, Eli Marrero, and Geronimo Pena. Anything that's jumps out at you there.
Yeah, the Belliard acquisition probably, I wouldn't say won it, but that was big, mm-hmm. you know, to get him for the stretch run in 06. I always enjoyed watching him play just because I always felt like he kind of had my kind of body type. You know what I mean? To be a big league infielder. What Marrero and Pena, it's funny that they're on the same list because I always felt like those two looked alike.
Oh, really?
I don't know if you agree with me on that one, but it was funny. Robin brought those two back to back. I was like, I always felt like those guys looked alike. Marrero's one of those that he could have been, and he was for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
He was a fan favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, backup catcher, backup mm-hmm. outfielder.
Yeah.
Hustled. He could run. He could play a little bit. Now,
No, he had. Oh, let me look it up and see. I don't think so. I don't remember what his background is. I'm thinking the only Cuban defector I can remember the Cardinals ever signing was Rene Arocha.
The first one.
Yeah.
That played in the league.
Yeah.
For some reason, I think Marrero was, and I may be completely wrong on that.
Oh, yeah, Marrero. Sorry, I got the. Now, I'm pretty sure he had a. Let me see. Let me look it up and see. He was born in Cuba, but he was drafted out of Florida. He went to high school in Florida. So, you know, a Cuban defector, yeah, because he was born in Cuba, but he wasn't necessarily what we think of, you know, in that regard.
Exactly. I wish I knew more about Cedeño and Frisch. I probably need to study up a little bit more on that. I think it's funny how many of the 90s players that we got that were on really bad teams that we've got really like with Pena. Like, I don't know. I mean, he's just synonymous with some of those rosters that were really bad. For me, in my
eyes. Oh, yeah. No, no. Yeah, he was right in there. I mean, he was a guy that, you know, came up as a rookie and he had a little power at second base and we kind of got a little excited about it, but it just didn't last, never really developed.
Yeah, I mean, I remember along those times of, there was Pena, you know, Polanco, who I always liked.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, Luis Ordaz, those guys at the time, and you can go back to a lot of those names where you're just like, I like a lot of those guys, but man, those rosters were pretty bad, which in 5 years we may be saying about this team, unfortunately, you know, after Pujols was gone, you know, or after Holiday was gone, we can say that, but it is amazing to me that this is either our fourth or fifth grouping of players, and I think there's been one of those guys in every one of the lists.
Yeah, I think that's probably because, you know, like you said, the 90s guys didn't. They're people you remember, that you might, especially if you came to baseball in the 90s, you might have a fondness for, but they don't have that overwhelming push, and that's why they're sitting down here low in the list.
Yeah, that's true.
Eli Marrero, besides the fact that, you know, he was also part of the Adam Wainwright deal, went over with Drew to the Brewers, or to the Braves, remember him, it's kind of the Colton Wong type of thing. He was playing outfield in Chicago on a rainy, rainy day. Game should have been called. He went after a ball, slipped, and tore up his ankle. And then, you know, like an inning or so later, the game was called, and it didn't count, and they had to play it again. And it was like, you know, it was one of those things. I mean, I remember watching that game, and, you know, you could tell at the time. It's like, why are they out there? And to see that kind of injury. But yeah, to have a guy, you know, I mean, if we could take a backup catcher now that could hit like Eli Marrero, I mean, you'd love that. Even if he didn't play outfield. Because for a while, you know, he had a couple years, you know, hitting 260, 262. He had, you know, a year with 18 home runs. You know, his overall numbers with the Cardinals are not that great because they're 238. But he had 43 homers in 7 years. I mean, it's, you know, if you're backing up, that's not too bad.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he was super athletic. I mean, he could run, he could play, had a cannon. Mm-hmm. And I remember him very, very well. And I always thought that there was we could go off the rails on this, and I told myself. Yeah, it brings back a lot of memories to hear that name.
Yeah. Yeah, as for Frankie Frisch, like you said, a guy that we don't know a whole lot about just because he's playing in the, you know, the 20s or whatever. He managed the Cardinals in the 30s. You know, Hall of Famer. And a guy that you obviously know the name of when you start talking about historical names, but, you know, you just don't necessarily know as much about him as you'd like. You know, he played about half his career in St. Louis and did well, hit 300 or better, let's see, four or five times, maybe six, maybe more than that. It's just pretty impressive, you know, obviously, like I said, Hall of Famer, and I know some of the people from that era, you know, get into the Hall of Fame and they're not quite as good. But Frisch was always good. I mean, he got traded for Rogers Hornsby. That tends to be a good thing. But yeah, just not a guy we hear as much about because of the age to it. All right, sevens. Let's look at sevens. We've got Peter Borges, Ken Daly, Enard Diaz, Dan Heron, Juan Nicasio, Ken Reitz, and Stan Royer.
The Enard Diaz is one that kind of...
Well, that's from our guy that picked Yadier Molina and all the backup catchers, so...
Borges was such a disappointment. Mm-hmm. I will tell you, I was so excited about that deal. I knew that Freeze was going to be traded, and it's one of those where just the timing didn't work out. It kind of feels like a Grichik-type situation now to where, you know, he's right up against making serious money.
Right.
And, you know, you never know. You just probably know there's going to be a part in ways. But when they traded him, I mean, I was a huge Freeze fan, even before the homers. I really liked him. And whenever he was traded, I loved Borges. Because I always thought the Borges would be like a 2020 guy. And thought, this is going to really help them out. And one of the reasons I say that is I saw Borges completely dominate the Texas League one year. He was by far the best player on the field. He caught everything in center, and you couldn't get him out. You know, and he was incredibly fast. And I thought, man, that's going to translate well to the bigs. He's going to, he'll be a good player. So whenever they made that trade, I was thinking, whoo, they got him and Grichik. Who I remember Grichik was on their draft boards really high that the year that, you know, the Trout was in the same draft, and they missed out on it. And I loved it. I was thinking, oh, this is going to be such a, this is going to be a steal. This is going to be great. And, man, I don't know if there's ever been a bigger, really, disappointment than Borges. I'm sure you can find one, and it's maybe easy to find one. I don't think it would take a lot of looking, but it just, to be so fast, I thought he was pretty much overall a terrible base runner. It almost felt like he got in his own head, never really hit, and then ultimately wasn't as good a center fielder as we thought he was. I think he was kind of like oil and water in St. Louis, but that was one guy that I was really glad to get and then really regretted ever getting him, you know, realizing that he was playing in front of Jay, you know, for the most part of that season, and Jay was probably the better player.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like there was some legitimate complaints about Borges' playing time. You know, it's difficult to say. I mean, you're right. When he got the time, you know, it's very convenient sometimes to be that player that needs, you know, 2 or 3 weeks consistent play to get on a groove. Well, you know, how long's long enough? You know, how long are you supposed to get? How long do you have to suffer through a guy hitting, you know, 1 for 15 before, you know, hoping that it's going to click? Now, obviously, we saw Brandon Moss a few years ago. We know that can be a long time. But, yeah, I don't know. I do think Borges was a little bit disappointment. I think it's probably telling to some degree that Borges never has flourished out, you know, after he left St. Louis. I mean, nobody else has given him 150, you know, starts in center field or anything like that. So it may not have been just, you know, may have been he's just not that good. And they have a better idea evaluation of that. And that's fair. But at the time, yeah, I felt like, hey, why aren't we putting Jay out there? Why aren't, you know, but like you said, Jay kind of earned the time when he was out there.
It would be tough if you truly are a player that needs, you know, complete, consistent at-bats, like Borges would say he needed, which anybody's going to say that. Playing in front of Jay probably wouldn't be very easy. Because when you set, he would take advantage of it. You know, wouldn't hit the ball hard, but he would find a hole. You know, play decent in center field, you know, and that. It would be tough to win a job back, especially in Matheny's eyes.
Right.
You know, so you're right. I mean, that's it. But the tail may be out on Bortles as well. He's no better than a, you know, late inning replacement outfielder and a, you know, pinch runner type deal. Because he's really never got good. He's never really played well anywhere else.
Yeah, I don't know. It was kind of an interesting situation at the time, and yeah, I mean that was obviously the key to that deal, was getting him. But yeah, he played 123 games. They weren't all starts because he only got 383 plate appearances for the Phillies in 16, and then he played 100 games, 203 plate appearances for the Rays this year. You know, and just not, you know, it's been all right, but like I said, it's just kind of that backup. You know, he had 218 for the Cardinals, he had 223 for the Rays, he said 251 for the, you know, and then his other two stops. He just kind of, you know, well, let me look. His WAR is, you know, 0.6, 0.1. Minus 0.8, 1.3. I mean, he's not that much different than a replacement player. And, you know, it just seems to be the case, unfortunately. That 5.1 WAR he put up his, you know, real first full year, I think it gave us indication that of a player that he really, really wasn't.
Yeah,
that's true. Dan Heron, I think, is the big one that comes out of this list. I mean, you know, I remember him pitching in the 04 World Series, and remember being, I don't think I was too disappointed in the, when he was traded. I didn't like it that much, but the Mulder trade, the key, it seemed to be, because, you know, we were all prospect experts then, was Derek Barton. You know, he was going to be the next big thing, and I remember reading message boards where they, you know, showed, hey, the only guy that's ever done this, this, and this at this level was Albert Pujols, or, you know, something like that. I mean, the comparisons were very strong, and he was going to be the thing, and he never was. But obviously, Heron made that trade bad. I mean, if Heron had been what we, you know, just regular pitcher, or what they thought they were getting rid of, nobody would have won the Mulder trade. It would have just been kind of one of those deals that it didn't work out for either side. But Heron blossomed outside of St. Louis, and they, you know, there was for years there. He was he's a guy the Cardinals really would have liked to get back because they could have used that starting pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I remember I was trying to look up the years. There was a time where it was kind of a situation, kind of like Weaver this year, and or Weaver this year, a little bit of Reyes last year, to where Heron. What year was it? It had been 03.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to think who was in that rotation that year, but I remember there was midway through the season and into the second half where everybody thought that Heron would have been the better option as to what they were throwing out there, and I can't remember what it was at this point.
It's probably Brett Tomko. There was Woody Williams. Let's see. Woody Williams, Brett Tomko, Garrett Stevenson, Matt Morris, and Dan Heron actually made 14 starts, which put him fifth on the list. See who else made a start. Sterling Hitchcock made six. Kiko Calero made one that year. That's about it. So, yeah, unless... Oh, and Jason Samantachi, he made 16 starts, so they probably moved Samantachi out. When they brought in Heron, but I mean, yeah, I mean, he came in that was 03, and then like I said, I remember him pitching out of the bullpen in 04, and you know, then he went over to Oakland and just immediately blossomed. You know, in 3 years, he's an all-star, gets a big deal, and, you know, goes to Arizona, and so it's that one kind of hurt. It was one of Walt's rare misfires.
I don't know. The only reason is it a misfire if Mulder doesn't get hurt, though?
Well, but the problem...
I don't know.
The problem was, from all indications, Mulder was hurt when they traded for him. They just didn't really know.
Yeah, you're right about that. And Yeah. I remember a lot of those, but I don't. The thing is, I don't ever really remember missing here. You know, thinking, man, that trade sucks. But I don't know if there's any trades that I've honestly felt that way either. You know, I guess it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. I don't know.
Right. I mean, there's some of that. There's not been a whole lot of trades. You know, like I said, we've gone over Mozeliak's trades, and he's never traded away a prospect that really mattered, save maybe Luke Gregerson, which, you know, reliever. Actually, that wasn't him. That was a Walt move as well. I mean, there's a few Walt moves that did something like that, but haven't had a whole lot of guys that just, you know, Jeff Bagwell for Larry Anderson or anything like that. Smoltz, sorry.
Yeah, well, no.
That's no, you're
Smoltz
right.
Was Doyle Alexander.
That's right. You know, that's right.
They were close, but, and then they had to make that deal. But go ahead.
And that one worked because Doyle Alexander went like 7-0 for the Tigers that year, and then went to the World Series.
True.
So I mean,
that's
it worked out. But they didn't go to the World Series. You know, maybe they did. I don't know. That's way off topic. I remember. You know, because Heron really did. I mean, he moved up to one of the, I mean, he wasn't like the best pitcher in baseball, but he was in that, you know, second tier or so right off of that. I mean, he was pretty solid there for a while. And like I said, the biggest thing was that Mulder was breaking down. He wasn't pitching very well for the Cardinals. I mean, I still remember Mulder's, you know, 10-inning shutout against Roger Clemens, but that's like the only highlight I can think of out of Mark Mulder's career. He hit a home run in the first game at Busch Stadium, 3. So I think that's what burned more. Because if Mulder, like you said, if Mulder had pitched like we thought Mulder was going to pitch when he came over, that trade wouldn't have hurt nearly as much. But he didn't, and so it did. Anybody else out of that mix?
It was funny. A lot of those 80s teams that I really like, I usually try to do. And then we come across Daly, but you know, Daly was a bullpen guy, big member of the team, but nothing, you know, outstanding on that or anything.
All right. Let's look at the eights. Eights are Jed Jerko, Jason LaRue, Aaron Miles, Ken Obergefell, Sidney Ponson, Mike Tyson, Tony Womack, and Todd Worrell. I gotta say, I'm a little surprised, not too much, because just of all the massive amount of names you could put up there, I'm a little surprised Todd Worrell didn't get a little bit more love, given, you know, Rookie of the Year, and a guy that I know kind of, you know, finished his career in the Dodger organization and stuff like that, but, he was part of those 80s teams as well. I'm just a little surprised he's down a little slow.
Yeah, that's, I actually have Worrell down the list at the Redbird Daily, and I kind of took it because he's grouped in with a bunch of the pitchers from those 80s era teams. I don't think people understand the magnitude of what Worrell did for that 85 team. He was amazing to come up as a rookie to do what he did to close out games for them. You know, Herzog's on record of saying that he builds his bullpen from the ninth inning in. Mm-hmm. You know, not from the first inning on. And that says a lot, especially when you have a rookie, you know, of in a situation where that team was so good that the guy closing out games was a complete, you know, he was green. And he was huge. I mean, if he came in the game, you knew it was a done deal. He's one of those stories to where I'll be the first one to say that that's just a fickle position. You know, that's it's finicky. I say it all the time on here. He's a guy that he made a career out of it, and he was good up until the end, you know, with L.A. He was really, really good. And I don't think he gets enough credit in St. Louis, and this kind of shows that we may be right.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, again, he got hurt there close to the end, then he, you know, moved on to L.A., and like I said, it's, you know, anytime you list 15 Cardinals, it's tough to, you know, sometimes squeeze a guy on like that, but, yeah, I mean, I remember him being, you know, that big guy, the guy that got the outs and did it really well. I guess you probably want to talk a little about Ken Obergefell, my guess.
A little bit. That's you. What do you? Where do you remember Obergefell the most?
Honestly, not much anywhere. You know, I came to the game. Really came to following it closely in 87, so of course he's well gone by then. I guess, was he in Atlanta? Because I finally have a vague recollection of him being in Atlanta. That's, I guess that would be it. Let me pull up his career, but I feel like he came along and, you know, he's just, he played till 92, which is a little surprising, but.
That's what's funny about the Obergefell deal. Mm-hmm. That infield in the early 80s, you know, when they won the when they won the series, and he kind of handed the position over to Pendleton, which was funny, but that infield those years was really, really, really good. And then they don't lose a step bringing in Pendleton. It actually improved. But what's so funny about how that worked was, you know, Pendleton unseated Obergefell in St. Louis, and they kind of followed the same footsteps to Atlanta. You know, it was kind of a weird deal. You know, now he was Obergefell was gone. You know, 87 or 88.
88, so, he played 120 games for Atlanta in 88, and then 20 games for Pittsburgh. So
okay.
I don't know if he was cut, and then probably was cut and picked up by the Pirates.
Sure. Well, and it was probably closer than I thought, because I think Pendleton, if I'm not mistaken, Pendleton may have made. I can look. I'm right from my computer.
You got it. It's okay.
But I think Pendleton made his Braves debut in 90.
I would think 91.
91. Okay.
I'm gonna look and see. And yep, because 90 was that team that finished last. Whitey quit because he couldn't get anybody to work. But they had all those veterans, and it was, you know, Coleman and Pendleton and all those guys last year. And yeah, he went to Atlanta and won the MVP the next year.
Exactly. Hey, I love Pendleton. That was one of that was my brother's playing for Cardinal growing up. You know what I mean? He was such a stud. And, you know, Ozzy was one of those to where he was the front. I mean, Ozzy's my favorite Cardinal ever, but kind of a front runner. You know, like, where her and Pendleton were huge in our household. You know, just because they were kind of the grinders on the deal. But then you look and you're just like, man, Pendleton won an MVP.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? He played several World Series. I mean, you know, three as a Cardinal, and then or two as a Cardinal, and then, you know, how many ever with Atlanta? And it's, you know, it's a great career, and it kind of gets overshadowed. But yeah, it's funny. I've always thought it was funny how kind of their careers were similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Obergefell. And but yeah, Obergefell was the start of those early days of Ozzy. Ozzy came over, and there that infield was really, really good.
Yeah, this is true. The only thing I want out of these, Aaron Miles, not really because of him playing, but just because he, you know, his time on the mound inspired. Air Miles Fastball, which was one of the early Cardinal blogs that we had in the UCB with Christine Coleman and Tara Wellman. I think Jacqueline Conrad wrote there, too. There was three of them for a while there. I just know Tara and Christine off the top of my head for sure. But, you know, that was one of the pillars, especially for a number of years in the UCB. And so... Aaron Miles has a special place because of that. Let's do the nines.
Yeah, we're running late.
We're getting level. See if we can get through. There's a number of nines, but there's only like three tens, so I think we got a shot. All right, nines. Richie Allen, Andy Bennis, Mitchell Boggs, Don Otis Shields, Bernard Gilkey, Clint Hurdle, Steve Lake, Tom Lawless, Preston Wilson.
Wow. I say that as, you know, Bennis rings. Mm-hmm. That's a, I don't know. The Bennis brothers were studs. You know, I always felt bad for Allen. They always said that he was the better of the group. But yeah. But I always liked Andy. He was a big dude, competitor. You know, it's funny. DeShields is one of those guys in the early La Russa days that, you know what, I may be wrong on that. But DeShields was a good player.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he kind of came around and, I don't know if the timing was right. Now, when was the Shields?
Shields played in St. Louis 97, 98.
Okay.
Those 2 years.
So that was after the collapse was 96, right?
96 was the year that La Russa came and they went back to the playoffs.
Yeah, but when they had the Braves beat.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then they lost to the Braves. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I was going to say, because that was Gallego playing a lot of second at that time. Mm-hmm. I remember the DeShields coming over. DeShields was a stud. I mean, think about DeShields and Grissom and all those guys. Now, I know that I'm not talking about their time as a Cardinal, but that Expos team was good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that's one of those, that's a 94 what could have been. And then ultimately, 2 years later, or 3 years later, you know, he ends up in St. Louis. The Gilkey's interesting, you know, being the St. Louis native that, you know, he was a good Cardinal. It seemed like there was a lot of guys that were basically the same player back in those days. Mm. You know what I mean? I don't know. Just the same style of guy.
Yeah.
You know, Lawless, of course, from the home run.
That's the only reason anybody remembers Tom Lawless. So.
Exactly. And then I was glad. I try not to talk too much about the current dead level guys just because it's ad nauseum, really. But I was glad to see them get Preston Wilson, and I thought that made a huge difference mm-hmm. in 06.
Yep.
To get him. He was super athletic.
Yep, that is true. It helped. It helped a lot. So.
Yeah.
I was, anyway, just actually a minor point. DeShields was out of Montreal by 94. His last year was 93, so he missed that 94 team, but went to Los Angeles for 3 years before coming to St. Louis. Bennis, I think that the one thing besides I remember him winning the game in 2000 against the Mets in the NLCS, the only game I think they won, you know, that was the Rick Ankiel year and all that, and he stepped up and you know, he'd been hurt, his knee had bothered him, and he'd been out for a lot of that year, but he stepped up and pitched a real good game that year. But
was
also,
go ahead.
No, that's what you got.
Well, it was 2000 the year that we honestly thought he was retired? And then he kind of came out of nowhere?
Yeah, I think it
was.
Wasn't
that the one it was? Okay, that's what I thought.
That he went down in 2000. He pitched in 01 and 02 as well. So but I feel like it was 2000 where he went home and... let me see if I can look at the game logs for 2000 real quick. But you're right. That idea that they sent him home. He didn't pitch. He pitched August 14th, and then he pitched again September 4th in the bullpen a couple of games. And then the last couple of weeks. Yeah, I bet that was it. He kind of went home and or didn't go home, but he was hurt, and we thought he was done. He came back and like I said, made that last stand. But I also remember with Bennis is the first time he was a Cardinal. In 96 and 97, pitched well, liked it, obviously, you know. But they almost signed him. But the agent, which I think was Scott Boras, the paperwork did not get turned in until after midnight. And that meant he could not, at least at that time, for whatever, it meant he couldn't re-sign with the Cardinals. He went out to Arizona for 2 years and then came back to St. Louis. But I do remember that. It was one of those technicalities that the Cardinals wanted to sign him. He wanted to sign, and it just went down to the wire, and things didn't get filed in time. And they lost him that way. But then, you know, like I said, they brought him back later on. And Bennis was, a solid guy. And obviously, you see him around. He was on the Cardinals kids for a number of years. He's still around the area. I think that's about it. Remember Mitchell Boggs having to get traded away so Mike Matheny wouldn't use him. That's the biggest thing there. And I remember Gilkey and Langford coming up, you know, being that real good outfield, but, you know, and then Gilkey going off to New York. But
I was at a game, and I had actually written about it. I was at in St. Louis watching play Atlanta, and their outfield was Gilkey, Langford, and Brian Jordan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was athletic.
Yeah,
I mean it was pretty impressive.
Yeah, that was a good outfield for sure. And it didn't keep it long enough, I don't guess.
Yeah.
All right, our tens, like I said, just three of them, and we'll do that, and then we'll call it an evening. Jose Cruz, Mark Grzelanik, I can say it. I know I can't. Couldn't type it anymore, but I could say it. And Woody Williams.
Wow.
And what I remember the most about Woody Williams, I remember a good number of things about him. But he was traded, obviously, for Ray Langford. Langford went to San Diego. We got Woody Williams on August 2nd, because that's my birthday. It was right after the waiver deadline. They made that trade in, 2002? Is that when that was? Let me pull that up and see. I feel like it was somewhere around there, I think. And then, you know, Williams, for a guy that was a waiver guy, he stepped up and really became almost the ace of that staff for four years.
Well, he started game one of the series in 2004.
Yep. Let's see. Langford went to San Diego it was 2001. So, that was 2001.
I was guessing more 2003 just because it didn't seem like he'd been there that incredibly long when he did start that. I mean, I understand him starting game one in Boston was mainly because the NLCS had gone 7. Another reason why the Cardinals had nothing left in Boston. But he did start that game one. I always liked him, you know, just the Texan, Houston tough guy, and he was a good pitcher. I remember I was glad to get him. I hated to see Langford go, but I was glad to get him because if you remember, they didn't have any pitching.
Yeah.
And then ultimately it worked out. So,
You know, 4 years in St. Louis, 45-22 with a 3.53 ERA. I do remember, you know, and he missed, which year was it? It's 2002, the next year, you know, missed about half the year with an oblique injury. And that's when I really started realizing how severe those obliques can be. Because, you know, they keep talking about him coming back and he missed basically half the season right there in the middle of it. Before he was able to come back late in the year. All-star in 2003, and like you said, he started in game one of the World Series in 2004, and you know, and he was a bit of a mentor to Chris Carpenter as he's coming up and doing all that stuff. So you know, I like Woody, and like you said, he's more of a known, he is Texan, but he pitched a lot for San Diego because he went back to San Diego after the St. Louis deal. But he was a guy that was interesting and kind of fun to have. Anything else on any of the other guys?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think anybody that listens to this would agree with me, but Grzelanik was really good as a Cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gets overlooked. And what's so funny about that, about you bringing that up is, I listened to you and I were kind of trading off some cliff notes of the McKernan interview with Mozeliak this week. And McKernan and Mo brought up a story about how they had clubhouse issues in 2006, and that Edmonds made the comment of they just weren't the same team and they weren't as good because they didn't re-sign Grzelanik.
Yeah.
Or didn't bring him back.
All right.
And that was whenever that name popped up, that was the first thing that popped into my head. I was like, that's kind of fitting that happened this week. But he was a good player.
Yeah, a solid player, you know, the one season. And that was that kind of year.
Yeah.
You know, for a while there, the Cardinals rotated shortstops, but they also rotated second baseman. For a while. You know, he was only there for 1 year. But hit .294, 8 homers, and he hit for the cycle, if I remember right.
Seems right.
He may be the last Cardinal that did. I know John Mabry hit for one, but I think it was before that. He's not a guy that. Mark Grzelanik hit one Yeah. Oh, I should. Of course, it's going to take me to a retro symbol. A retro symbol link. Of course, it is. You know, Mark Tomasik is going to have it all about everything. Yeah, 2005. Hit home run, triple, double, and single against the Brewers at Busch Stadium 2. Yep, he was the last one because Mabry did it in 96. Nobody seems to have done it since then. So that and the no-hitter that Bud Smith threw in 2001. Cardinals have not had any of those milestones for a while. But, yeah, you're right. A good player and a guy that, if it wasn't for his name, I mean, it wasn't for Grzelnik, you'd probably just kind of really forget about him just because of that one season. And it was a season that, you know, wasn't anything special for the – well, I guess 2005 wasn't bad. I mean, you went, you know, you went to the NLCS. So I got my years off there. So, but still, not necessarily a lot of moments so you can cram into one year. So I probably would have been a little bit forgotten. All right, well, that gets us through the 10-pointers. That gets us through 71 players. We just have 118 more to go, I think. So we'll nice. Just keep we'll just keep plugging along and see how long we can do this. Alan, any last comments before we wrap for the evening?
Well, we've got there's getting ready to be a 2-1 lead for Houston in the World Series, and that gets us. I'm hoping for 7 games, just because as much baseball as we get. But I am kind of chomping at the bit for the that 5-day grace period to talk to free agents to expire and move into the off season, because I think it's going to be hectic. So we're getting close, and we're going to be missing baseball before too long. But I think it's going to be a pretty active offseason.
Yeah, and I mean, you talk about, you know, this time next week, let's see, game 4, 5, off day 6 and 7. Yeah, we'll be done.
Yep.
I mean, no matter what, we'll be done, and next week we'll be talking about, you know, people that are filing, and unlikely that there's going to be any moves this early, but I think the
rumors would be pretty heavy.
Yeah, and the GM
rumors would be pretty.
GM meetings, I think, are the 13th and 14th, I think.
14th, yeah, that's what I was going to say, 13th and 14th, and then at that point, you're a couple weeks from that 40-man roster lock and, and extending, you know, arbitration, not arbitration numbers, but extending arbitration, and, you know, you got to figure out roster guys, and, you know, Rosenthal's going to be a big one, so there's going to be, it's going to be pretty exciting.
Should be, and we'll be with you next week and talk about anything that might have happened, and then, as I say, go through some more of these players and see what we can bust out and bring some more memories to you. So until then, that's Alan. I'm Daniel. Good night.
Good night.
Shooter from the belt to the plate. A swing and a miss, and that's a winner. That's a winner. A World Series winner for the Cardinals.